Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast, the terrifying first days of Trump. You ask us, will there be a Brexit deal? Julia reveals this week's backbencher of the week.
And much, much more. Let's talk about Trump, Stephen.
Okie dokie.
Because I think what I've seen since the Orange Cheeto took office is the vindication of your kind of line before we came in, which was, you know, he is going to be as bad as you think he is. Like, don't... What about his campaign gave you any hope that he'd turn into kind of Ronald Reagan the minute he entered office? I watched the inauguration speech from Spain, where I was on holiday, which was very nice. And it was... I mean, it was a terrible, terrible speech, just on a fundamental structural level. But it was... I thought it contrasted very poorly with former Republican speeches. Someone put a mashup together, all of them, who talk about the kind of world order and America taking its place on a world stage. There was none of that in there at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think... So I didn't watch the speech live because I take the view that Trump gave a pretty clear idea of the kind of person he was in his campaign, and indeed in the last decade, and the way he's run his businesses, or rather not misran his businesses, and during his time as president-elect. I didn't think it was going to be great oratory. I felt I could read it in 10 seconds afterwards and be horrified by it like that without having to listen to his awful grating voice. And I feel validated by that decision.
Yeah, that was another great decision by you.
I think there have been two interesting separate sources of kind of Trump denialism, right? There are people on the centre-right who have like this done, oh, you whining liberals, blah, 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 Trump's going to be great, oh, you all hate every American president, who think it's going to be like Reagan. And then there's some people on the left who regard American hegemony as innately bad, who have kind of gone like, oh, well, it's same old, same old. I find I'm more in sympathy with the second view, although I think what those people are already realizing is not liking a hegemon which behaves via rules and is predictable and is a rational actor is a whole different order of terrifying to a hegemon which is not led by a rational actor, does not observe any rules, and also doesn't even have a kind of coherent sense of what its own self-interest is.
I think that's the thing that becomes very difficult to deal with, is the fact that I don't really know what Trumpism is beyond talking aggressively about kind of, you know, we're going to bring jobs home and being a bit sympathetic to Putin. It's quite difficult to predict where it's going to go in the sense of, you know, actually, because you can't ever believe anything that he says, right? Because often he will then say the same thing. So, you know, Ted Cruz has taken the opportunity to say that the US should pull out of the UN, right? And they're trying to push that. I actually don't know which way Trump will go on that, right? And you also kind of feel like if, you know, Ban Ki-moon was mean to him at 9 p.m, he might tweet at 9:30 that actually he is pulling the US out of the UN.
Yeah, I mean, there have been so many terrifying things about the last 5 days as we record this, although you will be listening to it on day 6, 7, I think. There have been so many terrifying moments that I already have lost count of them. But one of the more troubling ones is the way that his White House is already leaking things that we kind of knew, which isn't he's incredibly vain. He's obsessed with the fact that the inauguration crowds weren't as large as they were for Obama's.
He watches cable TV. I mean, I haven't got time to watch 24-hour news, you know, and I'm not president of the US.
I mean, I am firmly on team cable TV as far as Trump is concerned, right? Because there are basically three bad ways Trump's presidency can go. There's like the the like going around nicking as much stuff, leveraging the US state for money and eroding democratic institutions at home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, this is a really selfish sentence, but I don't live in the United States. And that is the best case scenario that I can see at this current point in time. Because actually the terrifying thing is, oh, where is your God now, Helen? Elizabeth Warren voted to confirm Ben Carson at...
Ben Carson in housing?
Yeah.
I feel let down by Elizabeth Warren, but I still like her folksy charm, so I'm going to forgive her this one. I think only Karen Gillibrand was the only one to vote against all of Trump's appointments.
Yep, Gillibrand she voted for one of them, Nikki Haley, who is the UN ambassador. I don't agree with Nikki Haley, but she is the only one who I would...
Mad Dog Mattis, ironically, is turning out to be, you know, the closest sane adjacent of all of them, right?
Well, I feel like Mattis is perfectly sane, rules-based, et cetera, all the things I kind of said at the beginning. The issue with Mattis is that it does break the norm about not having someone go straight from the military to the civilian branch. At this point, I'm not unsympathetic to...
Just feel like, do you know what? We're in so far deep into Crazyville that's... It's a really interesting situation, isn't it? Because you mentioned the fact that there's been so many mad things. Like, let's go through and see if we can even remember all the mad things. So first of all, there has been the defunding of any foreign organisation which will even sort of talk about abortion to people or provide any kind of abortion services.
Even if the thing that the US is funding them is like building malaria nets.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's every GOP president since Reagan has signed that executive order. Every Democrat has unsigned it.
Except this one is worse because the old GOP ones only were... So let's say that I'm a big development organisation. I'm Oxfam and I do help women secure abortions, but the funding for my US programs is for malaria nets. I still get that funding under the old gag rules. Under the new one, I not only don't get any US funding for a program in which I am offering people access to reproductive services, I also don't get any funding for any of my other programs. So it is much more far-reaching.
Okay, so there's that. I give that kind of... 7 out of 10 on the horror scale. I mean, we're going to have to use the full... I mean, we're going to be heavily concentrated at the top end of the mark, so let's not blow our gasket too soon. No climate data is to be given out, right? I think this is something that someone pointed out on Twitter, which I thought I hadn't really thought about. You know, we're talking about them getting very cross and lying about the crowd sizes and sending out the press secretary, Sean Spicer, to say, no, the crowds went as far back as the monument. They were incredible. If they'll lie about something there is a photo that proves them wrong that you can look at, then we're about to realise quite how much you rely on government statistics. And, you know, this is something that's true in the UK as well, is that, you know, you have crime statistics collected by the government, you have climate statistics collected by the government. Until now, researchers have relied on that data. Journalists have relied on that data. And if that stuff is not reliable anymore, that's a problem. And if that stuff is no longer allowed to be publicised, like the National Park Service Twitter feeds getting told off for tweeting or like suspended, right, for tweeting climate change stuff. Someone pointed out that NASA's climate change account hasn't tweeted since the 19th of January.
Yeah.
I'm going to give that 7 as well, because that's kind of low key.
What are you saving 8, 9, 10 for?
tweeting about the fact that Chicago might need martial law, right?
Nightmare. That was.
He did say there's been loads of crime there. I might have to send in the feds.
Yep.
I'm giving that an 8. I'm giving that a solid 8.
Okay.
What else have you got?
So what else has he done? There was another lie this time about the scale of his Electoral College win. One of the closest ever. It wasn't.
Oh, he's gone nuts about the fact that he thinks that several million people voted illegally, but he's also very sure they voted illegally for Clinton, so obviously we don't need to rerun the election.
And conveniently in California. I mean, I just feel if I was going to commit electoral fraud and I was a Democrat, I would have done it in a swing state.
I would have done it in Wisconsin.
Yeah, which obviously is pitch rolling for, again, to... You know, to say something that I said, and I'm just going to call people out on this. Every time I said this on the podcast, one of you, I'm pointing angrily at the microphones, would go like, Stephen, I think you're being a bit hysterical. I said there was a fairly good chance in 2016 would be the last Democratic presidential election, small d. Although obviously the last Democratic, because they did win the popular vote again. And what are they doing? It's pitch rolling for going, oh, to tackle this problem of voter fraud, in heavy inverted commas, we will have a variety of things which will make it harder for black people, poor people, other
Hispanics,
other groups which trend towards the Democrats to vote.
And
you know, this is a man who is refusing to accept the idea that his electoral college vote was not small, right? You know, he's willing to, not willing to accept the result of an election he won. What do we think is going to happen? And this is going to be 4 years in which they will have found excuses to fire a lot of people. And some people have gone, do you know what, screw it, I'm just going to take a lot of money and take a public service, public private sector consultancy job.
I think the thing I'm really interested to know is how the Democratic Party responds to that. Because it's an interesting question about, there was a great tweet, I can't remember, it was maybe it was like Mitch McConnell or someone saying like, you know, we want the same, we want the Democrats to show the same level of cooperation that we did over Obama's appointments. And you were like, is he self-sassing or not? Because, you know, they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't accept Obama's final Supreme Court nominee, right? They just kept that until the after the presidential election, the hope that a Republican would win and then Trump could make the appointment and that would swing the balance of the court and all kinds of things. But if you're a Democrat, the trouble is there is a huge incentive in that system now towards just relentless partisanship. There is no reward at all for any kind of bipartisan attempts, which, you know, the Republicans in under Obama ruthlessly just, they wouldn't even, incredibly sensible things, they just screamed and shouted their feet and stamped their feet. So I don't know what's going to happen now.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing about Kirsten Gillibrand, right? She and Cory Booker, which I'm more surprised by, is the Democratic senator from the right of that party from New Jersey.
Oh, I said Karen Gillibrand earlier, didn't I? Sorry, yeah.
It's fine. They have both, I think, realised where the mood of the Democratic base is. And I think some people, including, I mean, you know, Bernie saying he will do a deal on trade with Trump. I think some people in the Democratic Party from right to left have just misunderstood where the Democratic base is. And I also think the difficulty is the Democrats have an incentive in government working, right? So the costs of obstructionism to them are higher. However, I think what they haven't realized is the scale of how bad Trump is and therefore how important it is that it is a failure. And there actually isn't anything to be gained for the Democrats on going, oh, maybe we'll work with them on a stimulus bill here or a whatever bill here, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, just finally, Theresa May is off to Washington. She has a huge interest in getting a trade deal. I mean, the big headlines from Michael Gove's interview were all like, yeah, definitely, it's going to be okay post-Brexit. There's a big interest in the Brexity newspapers and Brexity politicians in talking up the idea that Donald Trump will smile sweetly at us in our future out into the world, you know, sunlit uplands. How well do you think that's going to go?
I mean, it's going to go pretty badly, isn't it?
The photo is going to be chronic. I mean, have you ever seen a woman who looks less impressed with giant grandstanding men than Theresa May? I mean, she's got a lot of experience. She's not going to be doing the thumbs up.
I think the prediction you can take to the bank is what will happen is, because he's suggestible to whoever he was last in the room with, right? And actually, one of the things Trump is very good at is that he has successfully co-opted most of the politicians he has defeated in some way. Actually, surprisingly, two people who I wouldn't necessarily have expected not to fall into this pattern have been Hillary Clinton and Harry Reid. He is good at both. Well, he's very suggestible. So I would expect that on Friday he will say everything that the Brexiteers and Downing Street want him. He'll say something like, "Yeah, we've got a lot in common in terms of trade. We've got a lot of
special
common
relationship.
Special relationship.
He'll utter the magic words Churchill and special relationship, yeah. And a lot of people go weak at the knees.
And everyone will go, oh, it's great. Look what a success this is. I mean, I agree with Ian Martin, himself a Brexiteer, on this. Trump has fundamentally changed what the foreign policy question for Britain is after Brexit. It is no longer really about trade or any of that kind of thing, although obviously those are still, you know, bread and butter issues. Trump raises a much more important question about being secure in Europe and what that means and what those challenges are. And yeah, but I mean, I also think that when the rhetoric about this Trump deal will only really be exposed after we've left in 2019, when obviously many other things, which I imagine we'll get to in part two of this week's podcast, may have started to come unraveled as well. But the big issues in a US trade deal, regardless of who the president are, is access to our public services and what you can put in livestock, right? That's not going to change. Trump believes that every
US... mean in terms of pharmaceuticals rather than in terms of body parts? Sorry, yeah. I'm still stuck on David Cameron. TTIP is over, Stephen. Surely the left rejoices. No, let's not get into TTIP. Yeah. No one has time for TTIP now. we'll revisit this in part two.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And now, Julia Rampen joins us to tell us who her backbencher of the week is.
Hello. And this week, I think it has to go to David Lammy, because although quite a few Labour MPs are now talking about voting against Article 50, I give credit where it's due. He's been talking about that since June.
He's an Article 50 hipster, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, he was there before it became fashionable, writing his op-eds for us.
Him, which I presume, because he's Tottenham MP, right? So his constituency, pretty Remain-y?
Hugely Remain-y. He also gains a ward from Hornsey and Wood Green.
Which is super Remain-y.
Yeah, kind of, you know, the heart of Remain-y. You know, full disclosure, you know, David Lammy and I, actually not my manner anymore, but David Lammy and I have known each other from before I was, you know, a political journalist, not least because for a long time when I worked in a shop, he and I would take the same bus home from Westminster.
That's a nice story. He's one of quite a few high-profile Labour MPs. We don't have an exact number yet for the number who won't vote to trigger Article 50, do we? But, Stephen, you wrote in your column this week that Tulip
Sadiq.
And Catherine West?
Catherine West is kind of probably the most significant name so far, because she's the MP for Hornsey and Wood Green, obviously fairly Remain heavy, but she supported him both in 2015 and 2016. So this is the big issue, right? There was some confusion about whether or not it would be a three-line whip, because he said he would ask MPs...
Corbyn
to vote for him, which is obviously the official way that you do that. Their line is they don't comment on whipping matters, but some big name supporters of Jeremy's on Twitter kind of went, oh, I'm sure that can't be true. The difficulty is he might have a three-line whip technically, but he can't replace Catherine West, Tulip Sadiq, Daniel Zeekner, the MP for Cambridge, also on the front bench, all of whom have said they will vote against triggering Article 50.
So it'll be a three-line whip, but if they break the three-line whip, there'll be no sanctions. What you've missed, Judy, is this is the week of people realising that lots of things that we thought were actual rules are more like kind of guidelines, because they're just observed by convention. But why else do you pick David Lammy?
I think he has been the most coherent about this idea of arguing in Parliament. So from the very beginning, he spotted that this really should be a debate for Parliament. And he also spotted the opportunity to block Brexit as we know it through Parliament. So I suppose he's a good way of talking as well about all the other MPs who aren't Labour and who are planning a much more forefrontal attack on...
Might you be talking about the SNP?
Yeah, let's start with them.
Go on, what are those bunch of lads up to now?
Well, I met quite a few of them last night, and in a very well-disciplined way they went around and said hello to everyone and basically delivered the same message.
Is this a Burns night supper, by any
Funnily
chance?
Enough, it wasn't. It wasn't like an Article 50 supper either, but it just happened to be on the same day. But basically, the message was pretty clear. In fact, it was only took 10 minutes or so after the Supreme Court ruling to hear from them that they were going to have 50 amendments. So I think their plan is, you know, death by 1,000 amendments as far as Brexit's concerned.
What happened in PMQs about the idea about publishing a white paper, Stephen? I missed that.
So Chris Philip answered, oh, so great service on Twitter and going on. Isabel Hardman is compiling a burn book of like oleaginous questions where, you know, where backbenchers stand up and go, would the Prime Minister agree with me that she is the best Prime Minister there's ever been? And he basically kind of went, are you going to publish a white paper? And she was like, why? What a great idea. And then I mean, obviously, one of the reasons why PMQ, I mean, there are many reasons why I hate PMQs, most of which precede Jeremy Corbyn or Theresa May. But one of the reasons why it's become even worse is neither of them can exactly think on their feet. So he then had this thing where he'd obviously planned to ask her about the white paper first. He then basically went, well, what time will this
where
thing you've already
what,
committed
what
to publish
yeah.
Be? But he actually did, I think, although she batted it back in the chamber, he has spotted an area of intense vulnerability for her, which is the nitty-gritty of these trade deals. He was like, look, can you commit that it won't open up the NHS to US multinationals? Obviously, she doesn't want to say something either way, but there are going to be big issues with every trade deal that we sign about the health service, about food, about visas, and we forget that the government only has a majority of 6, right? And on any one of these issues, sorry, 12, 11, 11, because Zach Goldsmith has gone.
I just thought, hang on a minute, what, did I miss another 5 biting the dust at some point?
Although, by elections.
They might get a few more. Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. They're much more vulnerable than they look, which is, again, is why no one, apart from Theresa May, can believe that she's not desperate to hold an early election, because she could, if the polls are correct, be sitting on a very fat majority indeed. What kind of award should we give David Lammy? I feel like we should offer some sort of award. You could have another, maybe David Lammy, if you'd like to call in, you could have a commemorative, nostalgia-filled bus ride with Stephen for old time's sake. That could be your reward for winning this prize. Thanks for joining us, Julia. And now for a section called You Ask Us. Okay, so the thing is, I didn't realise my original motivation for You Ask Us was a riff on the Manic Street Preacher song You Love Us.
I thought the original motivation for You Ask Us was to have a regular feature where we could rely on our listeners to provide us with content because we were too lazy to do so ourselves.
That too. But my inspiration for originally, obviously it's changed now to me just barking, but I think that there are probably other Manic Street Preacher songs that we could adapt to be useful
or indeed
user-generated content.
We could adapt the actual Manic Street Preacher songs you thought you were adapting.
What? I think it makes sense. You ask us, you ask us, oh, you ask us. See, it works.
I mean, to us, the only Manic Street Preacher song I can really identify is their cover of Umbrella.
Oh, my God. Sometimes I forget that you're like 12. Anyway, what have people been asking you this week?
Mainly they've been asking us, will there be a deal?
So there's a whole thing going on. So the Lib Dems, I think, have ended up in a place where they've got a strong line about the fact they're not defying the will of the people. What they want is a vote on the terms of a deal to exit, which seems to be doing pretty well for them electorally. Do you think this is the right way to do it? Do you think triggering Article 50 and then starting that 2-year process is going to result in us getting a deal?
I mean, no, I don't. Article 50 is one of the fun things about our Brexit debate, right? I mean, I found that one of the easiest votes I've ever cast to stay in. But a lot of the decisions for it are interesting because you can kind of see how they work both ways, right? So there is a very strong argument to leave that one reason why the EU is a terrible institution is because Article 50 is basically makes it so hard for the country which is leaving not to get an absolutely terrible deal. And the incentives it creates are so powerful in terms of it being a good idea to stay in. And obviously that offends a sense of natural justice, etc., etc. And, you know, theoretically, that's quite a good argument. I mean, the flip side of that is that all is true, and it's probably why it wasn't a good idea to vote to leave, because you just... It's impossible, as far as I can tell, to work out how any organisation, you know, even the most efficient, well-run international organisation, to agree something as complex as Britain's disentanglement from the EU in 2 years, right? It's just very difficult. So the kind of the three parts in the Commission timetable are basically divorce, so all of the stuff that we've already said we'll pay for and the final bill for that. Then kind of exit, so wider disentanglement, so things like assets, and then the kind of immediate transition deal, and then kind of finality, right? The final trade deal that will shape our relationship with the EU for years to come.
My question about it is, I think there might be a lot of things that happen that get very little scrutiny because they're very complicated and quite tedious, that then become huge landmines when people actually realise what they mean, like regulation of medicines and stuff like that, right? It's something that sounds snoozerific, but actually in 2 or 3 years' time, people are going to be going, what? We said what? We agreed what? Which, you know, twat of a minister agreed this?
You realise when you say snoozerific, you mean my whole plan for the August month when I have no actual news, but I am still required contractually to write something occasionally.
Yeah.
Just like every day to be like, here's another thing you haven't thought of. The other fun thing is divorce, right? So let's say that you are married to an Italian and you both live in Spain. And at the moment, if you get divorced, all of your custody rights, that is really easy. And obviously, it's hugely non-controversial that those things will remain the same after Brexit. However, at some point, everyone does have to agree, though, you know, those are things which have to be agreed. They are so small bore in terms of the economic consequences. It's very easy to see how they just get forgotten or they get shunted to the sidelines. And we only kind of, that only becomes an issue when, you know, in 2021, someone gets divorced and goes, hey, wait a second, what happened to all of my rights?
The thing I reserve the right to update this opinion when I thought more about it, but I do feel that what we should have done is gone to an off-the-shelf existing arrangement, like an EEA arrangement, right, as a transitional step, that so that, you know, everything was kind of as close as it possibly could have been previously, but we'd taken the decisive step out, and from there you could then dismantle anything you wanted to. Now, I understand totally politically why that would have been a very controversial thing to do, but I feel like actually for the long-term interests of the country, that would have both respected the mandate you have to leave and not plunged us into an ongoing years-long, you know, bun fight, basically.
All right, so I honestly don't know, so I'm going to do one of those maddening things that listeners always tell me they love, where I go on a very long rambling thing. So on the one hand, yes, obviously, it keeps the technical mandate. But the thing is, the EEA is a bit democratically dodgy anyway, isn't it? I mean, it's basically a deal given to Norway when their political establishment tried and failed to win a referendum to take them into the EU. And they were basically, right, okay, so here's like a structure which is a bit like that, but it's different. Yeah, it's the I can't believe it's not the EU membership. I think the difficulty is, although it was very close, and although I am highly dubious than people who say I'm willing to get poorer to reduce immigration mean a word of it, you can't be 52-48% out of a trade bloc. You either pool your sovereignty or you don't. You either are involved in a trade deal or you're not. So I think it is quite difficult to have a non-economically disastrous Brexit that doesn't violate democratic norms. It's one of the reasons why I was always very sceptical of the Liberal Leaver argument that, oh, you'll just go into the EEA, because the EEA is being an EU member but without any power. And the EEA was designed to be that. You know, kind of Switzerland's arrangement, I think, would violate democratic norms.
Here's the thing I've been trying to understand. You know, when people get very het up about leaving the EU, what is the thing that has to have happened for us to have left the EU, right? Because I can see that for Aaron Banks and for Nigel Farage and people like that, controlling immigration is the thing, but the sort of this, you know, what is the thing that, like, Dominic Cummings and Robert Oxley and all the kind of vote leave guys, what is the thing that has to happen for them to be satisfied that we've left the EU? What's the kind of quiddity of the EU?
I think there's a couple of things.
I would ask one of them, but we know that Dominic Cummings would write like a 90,000 word blog post that was just all about Boolean logic.
Well, I think some of it was the Michael Gove leadership platform, lots of spending in science, innovation, you know, people coming from, you know, all over the world, skilled immigration, all of that noise. The difficulty, and in some ways, the column I never work out what the next 500 words of it is, the referendum was about Cameron, not just because he's the reason why we had the blasted thing, but because for a lot of Tories on the right of the party, they have this idea that you leave the EU and suddenly it unlocks lots of things that are politically difficult, right? But actually, even if you are in the EU, so even if you're outside of the EU, people don't want to be like Singapore, not least because Singapore has a smaller financial services sector than we do, and has far fewer people. You just cannot support a UK style, a European style welfare state, which is what we have basically always had.
And which people really like. And people let's be honest, you can't take away people's social security without them getting really, you can't, like, things that people see in their lives, they notice when you take that away.
Yeah.
Do you know what, when you last mentioned us being like Singapore but with better weather, someone wrote in from Singapore to complain that actually the humidity there is very unpleasant and we shouldn't stop saying that. So you're allowed to say, next time we have to say Singapore but with more humidity.
Okay, fine. Singapore, Britain, but with less humidity. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I'm fine with humidity. I'm cold right now.
Okay, well, on that bombshell, we'll come back next week.
Thank you for listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, my co-host Helen Lewis. The music is by The Underscore Orchestra, Devil with the Devil, licensed by Creative Commons. Next week, we'll be discussing the continuing horror of the Trump presidency, as well as anything you want to ask us. But if you like the NS podcast, please do subscribe on iTunes, leave a review. If you don't like it, keep it to yourself.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.